This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
In many countries, the weather is getting more variable. Seasons are changing. Farmers don't know when to plant. When will the season start? How long will it be? These are key risks.
That's Sebastian Gray, a senior researcher with the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, talking about climate change. Details coming up.
Also, an experimental Ebola vaccine is being given out in the DRC to help stop the spread of the deadly disease. And opposition leaders in Burundi say they will not accept the results of a referendum that could allow the controversial president to stay in power until 2034.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, health workers in the DRC started giving out an experimental Ebola vaccine today to help stop the spread of the deadly disease. The death toll has risen to 27 in the country's ninth outbreak of Ebola, including a nurse in the village of Bikora, where the outbreak began. But the World Health Organization has hopes that quick action so far will prevent a major epidemic like the one in 2014 to 2016 that killed more than 11,300 people in three African countries. Overall, the health ministry says 22 cases have been confirmed as Ebola, 21 are listed as probable, and 6 as suspected. The vaccine is being given first to health workers, along with family and friends of those who already have contracted Ebola. It has since spread to the provincial capital Mbandaka, a city of 1.2 million people. There are concerns that it could expand rapidly from there.
Burundi's Electoral Commission just today announced that voters overwhelmingly approved constitutional changes. Opposition leaders in Burundi say they will not accept the result of the referendum, which could allow the controversial President Pierre Nkurunziza to stay in power until 2034. The opposition called the voting a parody and claimed a variety of irregularities and a campaign of intimidation. Human Rights Watch said it had counted 15 deaths and other crimes in the months leading up to the referendum. VOA reporter Mohamed Yusuf is in Burundi covering the vote. He brings us these details.
The provincial result shows majority of Burundian voters have approved a new constitution. The new constitution will allow President Pierre Nkurunziza or will give him a chance to run again come 2020. If the new constitution is adopted, it's going to give an opportunity the ruling party to abolish the ethnic power-sharing agreement between the two main ethnic groups, Hutu and Tutsis. That ethnic sharing power agreement, it grew out of peace process that ended Burundi's civil war. Now, many people are concerned about the president extending his rule to 2034 and also the abolishment of the ethnic quotas. Many fear if that ethnic quota of ethnic sharing power agreement is done with, it's going to bring animosity and it's going to bring intercommunal fighting in Burundi. If the Constitutional Court validate that result, then the document goes to President Desk for his signature. Nkurunziza's administration since 2015 has come under huge international pressure, but it looks like he has carried on. Now people have voted for a new constitution, which the ruling party claims is going to bring stability to the Central African Republic.
That was journalist Mohamed Yusuf in Burundi.
With the Bonn climate talks still underway, developing nations are calling for more assistance to adapt to climate change. Scientists from the International Center for Tropical Agriculture say helping small farmers use new technologies will be key to the effort. From Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
Agriculture, a major employer for millions of Africans, faces enormous challenges as a result of climate change. For example, the UN says sub-Saharan Africa receives only 5% of climate funds promised to assist countries in need despite being one of the most vulnerable regions in the world. Farmers say they are not getting the help they need fast enough. Timothy Larpey is a nomadic pastoralist from the Maasai community. He says fluctuating rains and dry periods are taking a heavy toll on local communities who don't know what to do about it.
We must educate our people. We must tell them what is climate change, because they don't understand. They keep waiting for the rain, thinking the rain is everything. Whereas we know really climate change is real, but people they are not aware. They're just saying, we hope maybe in the next few years it will rain. Maybe in the next few years it will rain. But the rain never comes.
Sebastian Gray is a senior researcher with the International Center for Tropical Agriculture based at the Regional Office for Africa in Nairobi. He agrees with Larpey.
As you can imagine, one of the main risks is related to climate change and weather variability. In many countries, the weather is getting more variable. Seasons are changing. Farmers don't know when to plant. When will the season start? How long will it be? These are key risks. And we need to help farmers to identify how to mitigate these risks, how to cope with these risks and adapt to them in the long term.
Gray says his center works to promote innovative agricultural practices that would help farmers adapt to changing weather patterns while reducing emissions and boosting food security.
For example, in Zambia, in a small town called Kafue, an integrated crop livestock approach to climate smart agriculture seems to work best. So this is understanding what are the crop in production practices, what are the livestock production practices, how can they be combined to make agriculture more resilient and more efficient. So for example, combining manure from livestock into the cropping system, using crop manure for biogas, integrating legumes into maize production systems. This sort of integrated system seems to reap greatest rewards.
Kafue's integrated crop livestock solution adds groundnuts or sugar beans to crop rotations to fix nutrients to the soil. There is also success in Rwanda, where improved soil fertility through land conservation tripled the yields of soybeans and maize. Gray explains.
Regardless of the crop that you are planting, there are climate resilient practices that you can implement. One of the promising practices is drought-resistant and drought-tolerant breeds and varieties. This is both livestock and crops. So for maize, for example, there are many varieties of drought that are drought-tolerant that are better suited to the local conditions that can be adopted by farmers. The same goes for livestock. Understanding the local conditions and the most appropriate breeds for those local conditions is crucial in building the resilience and productivity for smallholder farmers.
But funding, particularly in Africa, is severely lacking. Some say investing in African agriculture remains still extremely risky. The Zimbabwe-born agricultural expert explains.
We have to go down to the farmer level and understand what is appropriate for them in terms of culture, in terms of the environment, in terms of the costs and benefits. Going down to the local level can enable you to design more appropriate investments and as well attract private sector investment.
Specifically, Gray says the smart technology that would help farmers adapt to climate change is funded by donors. He says Africa will not be able to boost food production unless the continent takes several steps on its own. They include encouraging Africa's private sector to invest in food production and in developing new technologies that help farmers. Gray adds that means governments will need to develop new strategies, including microfinancing, that will help make private sector investments in agriculture less risky. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 14 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Experimental Ebola vaccine is being given out today in the DRC to help stop the spread of the deadly disease. and opposition leaders in Burundi say they will not accept the results of a referendum that could allow the controversial president, Pierre Nkurunziza, to stay in power until 2034. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Transnational extremist groups operating in the Sahel and West Africa have gained prominence with a rash of deadly attacks in the region. Experts say militant groups affiliated with Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and the self-proclaimed Islamic State thrive on poor governance, communal distrust, and social injustice. Anwar Pukar is a non-resident fellow scholar at the Carnegie Foundation's Middle East program, talks with VOA's Mohamed El-Shanawi about the fertile ground militant groups find in the Sahel region.
This is how all these violent, you know, extremist group and the jihadis, they thrive on issues of misgovernance, of issues of social inequalities, of issues of injustices. So the fact that these violent extremist group, whether it's AQIM or Murabitoun and others, they try to provide, you know, alternative forms of governments, you know, that are based on what some, you know, people on the ground crave, which is, again, you know, good governance, which is matters of justice and matters of economic development. And the areas that they have governed, they have proved, I mean, that they are much better than the states themselves, unfortunately. But for people, again, I can't emphasize it more, what they crave is social justice, or at least the perception that those that govern, you know, are trying to change conditions, you know, for the better.
So how do you explain the heavy reliance on military response to security threats to the Sahel and ignoring good governance?
And that's, you know, again, that's the million-dollar question. I mean, the G5 and elsewhere. I mean, the G5, you know, it's a good experiment. I hope it succeeds. But its primary mission was about development. But unfortunately, what the international community cares most about is security, is issues of migration. And development and governance, unfortunately, they're always pushed to the back burner. But again, these are the core problems. To raise more awareness that without addressing corruption and misgovernance, you cannot address, obviously, issues of insecurity.
What should the U.S. and the international community do to enhance good governance in the Sahel, which is becoming a basic source of instability in the Sahel?
There is the short term, there is the midterm, and there is the long term. In the short term, yes, there are security issues that needs to be addressed. So in that regard, I understand the focus on security. But my hope is that the international community will try to hold, I mean, these, you know, leaders accountable, whether it's in Mauritania, whether it's in Niger, or elsewhere. I mean, in the end, the United States and Europe, I mean, they do have leverage over these countries. So the question that remains is, why not use that leverage, right? Why don't you link, I mean, aid with at least improvements, or at least some improvement in the way that rulers obviously engage their citizens.
How important is dealing with the socio-economic challenges in border areas to overcome cross-border security challenges?
Again, I mean, the core issue when you survey, you know, border communities, I mean, the number one issue of concern is economic development. And frankly, I mean, issues of security comes at the bottom. But again, how do you define security? I mean, there is a difference of perception. I mean, the government obviously views security differently from the people on the ground. The people on the ground view security in terms of human security, is that we need more jobs, obviously. We need more development. We need to be treated with respect, you know, by the police and security services. And this is the view of security. So there is, unfortunately, the government and the people on the ground, they see things differently and they talk, you know, different languages. And that's a major problem.
That was Anwar Bukars with the Carnegie Foundation's Middle East program. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shanawi.
In an energetic presentation, World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus has kicked off the agency's annual conference by vowing to use his position to keep the world safe and to serve the vulnerable by promoting healthcare for all. Lisa Schlein reports from the opening of the week-long World Health Assembly in Geneva.
The overflow audience at the assembly enthusiastically marked the World Health Organization's 70th birthday. WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus agreed there was much to celebrate, but noted there was little joy in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where health workers were risking their lives to stop the Ebola outbreak in that country.
It's concerning that we now have cases of Ebola in an urban center. But we're much better placed to deal with this outbreak than we were in 2014. I'm pleased to say that vaccination is starting as we speak today.
Tedros said this was only the latest of 50 emergencies in 47 countries and territories to which WHO has responded in the past year. He noted the best way to prevent future disease outbreaks and emergencies was to strengthen health systems everywhere.
That's why we established a high-level commission on non-communicable diseases to stop the premature and preventable deaths of millions of people. It's why we established an initiative on climate change and health in small island developing states. It's why we're working on an aggressive new initiative to jumpstart progress against malaria, an entirely treatable disease that still kills 500,000 people every single year.
WHO has rolled out an ambitious new 5-year strategic plan, which aims to make a big impact on health. Tedros said the goal is to achieve the highest attainable standard of health for all peoples in the world, poor and rich alike. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Rwanda, like its neighbors in East Africa, is being hit by heavy rains and flooding in different districts of the country. The Ministry of Disaster Management and Refugees says that since January, the rains have caused at least 200 deaths. The ministry figures show that floods have damaged 4,560 hectares of crops and destroyed 9,974 houses. The Ministry of Infrastructure says the rains over the past 4 months are the worst in years. The government is urging people living in danger zones to move to higher land, but many say they don't have the money to move. They also say the government is not providing adequate support to them, only blankets. Kayumba Regina Olivier is the permanent secretary in the Ministry of Disaster Management and Refugees. From Kigali, reporter Eugene Uwimana spoke with him about the situation.
So the areas which are mostly affected, we have Karongi district, we have Ngororero. It's almost 9 districts which were affected.
What kind of support are you providing those at risk? Because some complain that they don't have the money or the ability to move. And some say the government is only providing blankets.
What we are giving as support, we are giving out iron sheets to those people who can manage to rehabilitate their houses. We are giving out, of course, NFIs, non-food items, and we are giving out assistance in cash to families who lost their beloved ones.
Is the government working with any NGOs to solve the problem? Is it coordinating with the UN or other East African groups to provide relief?
Currently in Rwanda, we have assistance that we have got from some international organizations. We have UNDP, USAID, CARE International, Trochea Action Aid, UNICEF, Red Cross that are also helping, assisting and helping the efforts of the government.
What are the challenges the government is facing in the effort to save lives?
Of course, the challenges are existence of the high-risk zone and the mindset of people who really don't accept to cope up with the instructions. The government is making efforts with the local government and local authorities to move those people from this high-risk zone. Funds, it's not a big challenge. When you have a determination, you'll get the funds.
How big is the risk of massive internal displacement of the environmental refugees?
No. We don't have environmental. We have issues of environment, yes, but we don't have environmental refugees, no. We have people, of course, who are being relocated and being accommodated by their relatives, and where we don't find directly some relatives, we have public buildings. That's where we are putting them, and we are giving them all the facilities. In the meantime, the district and the local government are finding ways to get new buildings or new houses, affordable houses, to relocate those people.
Is the rainfall and flooding expected to harm the economy, including food crops, for subsistence use or for the market?
Definitely have some consequences if you can move from Kigali to the southern part. You'll find agricultural area which were affected by flood. So definitely have some shortage, food shortage, but it's not very, very big. And the Minagri status today is that we'll cope up with that situation and will not face any problem. What I think is that we are facing issues of climate change in the region, of course. Yeah.
That was Kayumbu Rugina Olivier with the Rwanda Ministry of Disaster Management and Refugees. He was speaking from Kigali with reporter Eugene Uwimana.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
VOA Africa presents a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
It's difficult to recognize Ebola because the signs, sudden fever, diarrhea, vomiting, are shared by other diseases. It's quite difficult for anyone, except a healthcare worker, to say definitively, yes, it is Ebola, or no, it is not Ebola. So if you have sudden fever, diarrhea, or vomiting, and you have been in direct contact with someone who is sick, you should go to the health center, because no matter the cause, you can receive help there. And remember, with the right information and together with our healthcare workers, we can protect ourselves from Ebola.
That was a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, brought to you by VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, warring factions in South Sudan's civil war are scheduled to begin meeting in Ethiopia on Thursday, May 17th, in an effort to end the brutal conflict. Despite several agreements and ceasefires, the fighting continues. South Sudan in crisis, on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.